On behalf of our group, I welcome you, Dr. Valerie Carter Smith, married to Elrich in 2018. She has two grown sons. Valerie grew up in Long Island, and amidst life's struggles, she became a follower of Christ. And over time, God has continued to reveal to her how to minister and work in the world. She has a Master's of Divinity from the School of Theology at Virginia Union University, a Master's of Social Work from VCU, and a Doctorate of Ministry from Baptist Theological Seminary at Richmond. We have some other graduates from there on here. She served in various church ministry roles, participates in ministries like the Streetwalk Ministry, which reaches out to women who are caught in prostitution. She's been a teacher in sociology, and currently she serves as the executive director and treasurer for the Women's Missionary Union of Virginia. We are so glad that you are here tonight. She's generously agreed to share with us on the topic of prejudice in the church. And tonight she's going to focus on how prejudice showed up in the past, in the earlier church. And next week she's going to steer us towards the present places where it's experienced. There are some serious issues that need our attention and work in this world and country and community. So we are going to give our attention to these matters. Let's share in a word of prayer as we begin. We shift our attention to matters that we believe are important to you, God. For it is your desire that we would live in love and harmony, in shalom. Oh, that we would see the beauty of your image in one another, seeing the beauty of your creativity that has fashioned differences in us as a gift to us. As those who follow Christ, brother and sisterhood must come, must abound. But Lord, we seem so far from that place yet. Guide us with your Spirit in this conversation and then in our intentional living. Lead Valerie Carter as she shares from her studies, experiences, and from her heart. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Valerie, we're so grateful for your presence with us tonight, and we welcome you. We will let you take the floor.
Okay. Thank you very much, Anna. I give honor to God and to all of you, God's people, to your pastor, Brother Reverend Daniel. I'm just so glad to be in your presence. I am not a specialist on this, no matter how awesome that bio sounded. I'm just a fellow traveler on the journey, just trying to make it. And always thankful for Christ coming into my life and turning me around and connecting me with Virginia Baptist. A journey that's been a blessing, certainly not a journey that I anticipated or strategically planned. It kind of fell on me. I tried to get out on many occasions. Nothing ever happened anywhere in the country for me. And this is where I've been, and God is good. And this is where God evidently wanted me. So, Anna, thank you for your kindness in facilitating and briefing me on where to go here. As I present in these few minutes I have, take your notes. Be ready for Q&A or comments or thoughts. Please know, as a minister of the gospel and certainly as a sociology professor, you don't have to agree. That doesn't mean we're not friends. I got friends of every nation, tribe, tongue, religion, political orientation, you name it. It's all good. So please be ready to challenge or affirm or whatever you want to do. I hope, Anna, I meet your request about past and present. I'm not sure if I got that 100%, but you listen attentively and you will hear it weaved in and out, particularly when I get to a certain space in my presentation. Given the description of our time together this Wednesday and next Wednesday, you all at River Road Church Baptist are looking at prejudice and how it shows itself up in the church today and certainly yesterday. The church has been a leader in supporting and perpetuating discrimination and exploitation. Those are the words that's on your description. I would remind us, not only in the church today, but prejudice was also evident in the early church as well. And I'm sure that Dr. Spencer has taken care of all that with you guys. I think he has presented already for you. Certainly all the scripture texts on the Greeks and the Hebrews and the tension that existed there. And then when you stretch out of Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, then you have the hybrid groups there and the conflicts that happen. Thank God for visions from the Holy Spirit that tells disciples that what God has clean, let no person call uncommon, right? And that we're not to be stumbling blocks for one another. So this idea of prejudice certainly is not new. Our goal tonight, the way I've outlined this, is the following. One, to clarify some key terms. Two, to offer content that can be used as discussion points. And three, engage with the hope that we all commit to a journey towards healing individually and as a community of faith and as a Christian nation. A couple of terms that I would like to define the way I use them. We're not in an academic setting where we can sit here and argue forever and ever about the terms, but this is how I use them. Prejudice. Overt prejudice is about denying simply based on denying one or another or a group simply based on race and stereotypical characteristics. There's subtle prejudices in the system, and those include actions that limit access, for instance, to jobs, to training, to mentoring or promotions, or opportunities in hospitals for treatment in terms of health disparities. So prejudice can be overt. Prejudice can be subtle. I'd like to add to that, my opinion, it also could be unconscious. I didn't read that anywhere else. When I have dealt with prejudice in Baptist life or anywhere, a lot of times I believe it's unconscious because it's so much in the fabric of our system. Now, we're talking about black and white prejudice, but that could be prejudice against someone who is otherly abled. It could be prejudice to someone with another sexual orientation, prejudice or whatever. Some of it, I do believe, is unconscious. So that's why I personally don't take it personal. But that's me. I might not say that in every venue. So prejudice, discrimination. Discrimination, I use, is the unjust or prejudicial treatment of different categories of people or things, especially on the grounds of race, age, or sex. I say that discrimination is the act resulting from prejudice. It's the act. So I might be naturally, innately prejudiced because it's natural to some degree, in my opinion, to size up people you meet along the way. First images, first impressions, your brain starts calculating thoughts based on your history, your background, your context, right? So if I act on those prejudices, then what am I saying? Then I'm discriminating against a certain person or a certain group of people. So I say that discrimination is the act resulting from the prejudice. Last term I would like to clarify, as I understand the term, and we talk about it in sociology, is the definition of racism. Racism is a distinctive practice, system, or philosophy, typically an ideology or political or theological ideology. And so unlike prejudice and discrimination, racism is more of a macro theoretical concept that inversely impacts groups in every area of their life. Racism is an ism, if you remember nothing else. It's an ism, which means it impacts to a greater degree. So I could be prejudiced against Paul Honaker because he's a musician, right? And I worked with him for 11 years and he was hard to work with. So I'm prejudiced against musicians or whatever. But when I end up in a power position in our country where I could hinder the opportunities or constrain all musicians for the most part, some might make it through the cracks, there are some outliers, then that becomes an ism. Can anyone think of any other isms? When we think about macro, big systems, isms. I know you're not muted, but you can unmute and just say the word.
Socialism.
Socialism.
Nationalism.
Nationalism.
Patriotism.
Patriotism. Great, great. capitalism, just isms, right? So ism is much bigger than prejudice and discrimination. Ism is what we're hearing now in the news about systemic discrepancies and inequalities and injustice. And a lot of average, everyday, walking around, talking, living, eating, worshiping people somehow can't make that leap from the micro to the macro. Let me try to give you an example. I'm sure you all get it. And I don't know if this is the best example, but pretend WMU is like a nation or whatever. In WMUV, if I only hired Black women, I am prejudiced, for instance, against white women. And thus, I am discriminating. My acting out my prejudice against white women impacts individual white women's lives. Theoretically, this would not be considered racism. Hear that. Theoretically, it would not be considered racism, as I have limited power and authority, and my act does not impact the masses of white women in the community, in our state, in the world. That white woman can go to the next place of business and secure a job or use her network system to make connections to get employment. Thus, that as given that example, it would not be considered an ism. Would I be prejudiced? Would I be discriminating? Yes. I only want to hire Black women. I'm not hiring white women, right? On the other hand, if WMU ran the whole country, or if there's a WMU that holds high employment numbers across the country, all of our states, and if all the WMUs had all Black execs for the most part, and the execs primarily hired Black women, this is the nation called WMU, then we would be, because we're in the power and authoritative position, perpetuating an ism against white women, which means that we would be hindering the opportunities, we would be constraining white women because we hold authority and power, right? So one little Black WMU director in the United States, now this is not true, by the way, I do need to say that, this is not true. I'd say I'm only hiring Black people for no other reason, and they're gonna have preference when they walk in the room, just because of who they are. My experience and context with Black women is more comfortable, right? We share same culture. I'm gonna just hire them. I'm not really racist in that sense. Until I can wield and exercise macro or massive power and authority to subjugate all white women, because we don't want nobody hiring them, right? Give Black women preferential treatment. That's when it becomes an ism. So that's a sticky wicket to talk about, because most people in my experience have a hard time grasping that hair of a difference there, right? So yes, I can be prejudiced and I can discriminate. And to some degree, some degree of it may be inherent, you know? But an ism is a different level, right? So I wanted to talk about those three terms. Some talking points, the first one, and I kind of hit on this a little bit. We confuse prejudice and racism. I'm just going to read this and move on. To be racist, one must have the power and authority to subjugate an entire group of people. Prejudice on a massive scale from one group or another promotes racism. And then I gave you that example of WMU as a nation or as a major institution. So that's the first point I want us to get tonight. The second talking point. And this is a basic sociological principle that's used in every introductory class across the country, no matter the university or college. The context in which one is born determines his or her opportunities and constraints. The context in which one is born determines his or her opportunities and constraints. Now, the skeptic will say, well, there's outliers. IMB missionaries used to tell me years ago when I was a young missionary working under Reverend Joe Glaze, IMB missionaries used to tell me at World Missionaries Conferences, well, look at Oprah. Oprah's done it. What's the matter with the rest of the Black people? Oprah's done it. I'm like, that's an outlier. You can't compare Oprah to anybody of any race, of anything. That's just so far out there, right? And I used to explain to this IMB missionary who used to attack me at World Missions Conferences, But she was a great missionary overseas. That's a whole nother dynamic. We'll talk about missions on Wednesday in race, but next Wednesday. But I said Oprah's an outlier. We talk about the masses when it's consistent pattern for generations. So the context in which one is born determines his or her opportunities and constraints. In other words, our social context formed us, and family is the number one socializing agent of the child. It does not mean that there aren't any deviations. I would like to give you an example. The first time I preached at the church I worked at, of course, Bon Air, this group, y'all all know that, Travis thought he had to take care of me the first year as the first African-American pastor on staff, first person that wasn't in janitorial crew at the church. And I kept telling Travis, look, I can fight better than you. I can take care of myself. You know, you don't have to baby me. I'm a big girl. But the first Sunday I preached all three services, and not the first Sunday I was there. I mean, but when it was my turn, at the 11 o'clock traditional service, and Paul, you were playing, an 80-something-year-old gentleman gets up. He stays through the whole service, all of Paul's beautiful music, and, you know, everyone loves it. And when it's time for me to preach, he gets up, walks down the middle of the aisle, across the front, and out the side door there. Everyone in church could see him. So the senior pastor came to me afterwards, and he was embarrassed. And he said, I'm so very sorry. I said, Travis, you don't have to be sorry about that. I said, the context in which one is born determines their perceptions, their views. I said, he's 80-something years old. I said, the world is changing rapidly for him. And the last thing that someone wants change is their religion or their Jesus. Don't mess with my Jesus. Don't mess with my concept or understanding of God, right? So now, I would probably be more troubled if that was Daniel Glaze getting up walking when I started to preach, you know. But I understood where that man was. And as a street mission person, you give me a year with that guy, we're best buds. I'll be calling them grandpa. You know what I'm saying? Because I'm that kind of person. So I go to Appalachia, only black many times on the mission trips, especially back in the day. And people think I'm weird at first, which I am when I get there. But by the time the week is over and I've done sheetrock or I've done whatever I'm doing, and I want to hear grandpa's stories on the porch when we start hearing other people's stories, to hear the struggle of living in Appalachia and how his family got to this country and the struggles to survive, the prejudice of the British against them, because they maybe they're Irish or something like that. By the time I leave after that end of the week, I'm hugging and kissing grandpa and sending him letters, you know, notes after I get home, because you have to understand social context. So I was not mad at the man who walked out. The world was changing for him. And now this crazy pastor has an idea of a multicultural congregation, people of every nation, tribe, and tongue. The world is changing. I don't like the way it's changing. I can't keep up with it, but you don't mess with my Jesus, right? And my understanding of God. So understanding that concept. The next talking point I would like to share with you has to do with the reality of a cumulative impact and trauma. Of the cumulative impact for all of us, for generations in our family patterns, for the trauma we've experienced in our families or as individuals, certainly as African-Americans, the trauma is off the charts, from the triangular slave trade to the auction blocks on the East Coast and in Louisiana, from the auction blocks to the plantation, from the lack of permission to speak your tribal language, inability to speak with other tribal groups, the breakdown of language. When you break down language, you're lost, really, when you don't have a common language. You know, you have to deny everything, and then you don't have your family because you're split up in your property, right? So at my wedding, Paul played for my wedding, and we had the jump the broom time, Paul. Wasn't it awesome? And Frank and I jumped the broom, and I had the pastor give a history of why we jumped the broom. Because we were chattel as blacks in America. We were not allowed to get married by law. We were not considered human, although the master could come to my shed every night for sexual pleasure, right? But we weren't human. But we had to have some sense of morality to say, you know, we gotta be married. So the community said, everyone has a straw broom because we swept dirt, right? That's what you did outside, and you swept the wood floor if you had a floor. That was wood. And so the community said, if you two, Paul and Linda, are courting each other, you got to make it official. It wasn't legal because the group that's in charge determines the laws. right? So it was the community's way of saying, you two jump the room, Paul and Linda, and the community recognizes Linda as yours and yours as Linda, and off charts. But you could wake up the next morning and Linda's been sold to the plantation in Georgia. So you look at the cumulative effect of the breakdown of the family in the Black community, we still see some of that today. You're only talking about four generations, five generations. So you still see the impact. You know, so there's a baby mama, daddy over there and the baby. And then, when we worked at the Baptist Center with Joe Glazer, our boss, you know, it would be like kids would be at the center playing. And then they would say, a kid would walk in and say, my daddy is coming over. And then somebody has to say, who is that? That's my daddy too. So it's a cumulative effect that unless we break these curses and recognize them, first of all, and break them. So understand the impact of trauma. So for Black Americans, you have the triangular slave trade, the auction block, the dehumanization of their personhood, emancipation, Jim Crow, and the continued racialized discrimination we have now. I was looking at some images the other day of Blacks in America, and I didn't want to get permission to show them today, so I chose not to show them. And in a lot of these pictures of lynchings across the United States, Black bodies being lynched, I don't know how much y'all know about lynching, but they were parties for white America. And so you talk about in the church in the past, there were picnics on Saturday. My husband won't let me use the word picnics. See, I'm from New York, so there's civil war in the house sometimes, okay? We're both Black, but there's still civil war in the house. Second husband who's a Southerner, right? So I use words that they say, we don't use that down here. And I'm like, why? I'm going on a picnic. You can't say that. That was pickup, right? And so when they lynch, you wanted a trophy. So Dean would get a finger of the guy who was lynched or something to take home for a trophy. And if you look at pictures, just Google it. You can see the pictures. So in the South, you know, there's no more slavery, but there's lynching like crazy. There's Ku Klux Klan who were deacons in your church, right? Who were mayors and who were, you know, so intricate part of the system. And so in some ways it was no separation, because when one group thinks they're supreme or they have divine right, you know, there is no separation. There doesn't have to be a separation. So I could worship in the Anglican church over the slave castles in West Africa. And when there's a, 800 slaves laying in their feces down in the dungeon, for 3 months waiting for the next ship to come from Europe to get them out of here for property. Or I could have the Saturday picnic and show my kids and my kids' kids, because it was a family affair, and that this, we lynched this in person, and here's a trophy, and we talk about it, and we go worship and sing Amazing Grace tomorrow, right? So in the psychic, there was no dichotomy there. We could see it in hindsight. Hindsight's always better. Right? And so, but remember that kid in that group that's chanting, get him, you know, that kid is also the product of the context in which he or she was born, which determine opportunities or constraints. So these images are worth looking at. I didn't put any together today, but when you look at Black subjugation, this is after slavery, you also look at white anger and rage, even if it's perceived. A lot of the anger, rage, and fear we have, and this is appropriate for our political situation today, is unfounded, right? But when the human mind perceives something, whether it's real or not, it becomes real to them. Does that make sense? I have mental illness in my family really, really bad. And schizophrenia, bipolar, I think one's narcissist, it's just bad. And I've lived with it my whole life. Beginning to have questions about the way my mother treated me, if there was something there. In those days, you didn't talk about it, so I don't even know. But one thing I had to come to terms with is my brother who just passed in New York, who had schizophrenia, he used to always see lizards on his legs if he wasn't taking his medicine, or snakes. And I would sit there when I was a young mother, when he moved down to Richmond, no, there's no snakes on your legs, Daryl. And I would just go back and forth with him, no. And my late husband, who worked in behavioral health, would say to me when we got caught, why do you stay out there in Creighton Court arguing with your brother? He suffers with a bona fide mental illness called schizophrenia. At this moment, of course, he's not being treated. If there are snakes and lizards that he can't get off his legs, there are snakes and lizards on his legs. And it's just as real in his mind. And I'm sitting there, you know, trying to rationalize. So when you go look at these images, not only look at the Black suffering, but look at the white rage and the white
what whites are going through. So I think whites also have unacknowledged trauma, right? Even in your generation, looking at me on screen, that had to inherit this story from your great, 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 greats, right? So there's pain there too. So they have to be broken intentionally. When I got married, Paul was there. My wedding almost 2 years ago was the United Nations, right, Paul? It was the United Nations. Everybody's there. My husband speaks a little Korean. He speaks a little Spanish. Never went to college. He's a truck driver, small business owner, starting Bible college in a couple of weeks. But we both love people. Like he'll say to me, my friends from Honduras will be here at 5 o'clock. This is 1 o'clock for dinner. And I'm like, how do you know these people from Honduras? You know, but he says, because on the road, he helps everybody. So if someone's being discriminated against and treated bad, he said, is that how you learn how to speak Spanish? I went to school. And I still don't conjugate verbs very well. You know, he says, well, I have to help them because the Mexicans are treated so bad. So I learned how to speak Spanish, you know. And so so at my wedding, though, I had Black people say to me, Paul, I didn't tell you this. What are all the white people doing at your wedding? And I had a Black young lady left the reception because she came to me. She said, I need you to know I have to leave because you set me at a table. And I said, well, the way I did the seating list, because I planned the whole wedding, the flow of it, I'm gifted at that. I seated eight, it was table seated eight. I put four people like that knew each other. So it would be Paul and Linda and Khaki and Ron from Bon Air. But then there were two other couples or people that didn't know Paul and Linda and Ron and Khaki. And I hate to say this, I'm a missionary. I had to do that. I'm sorry, y'all. I just had to do that. And some friends were made out of that as well. But this particular girl said, I got to go. You set me at a table and there was no more room at the Hilton. You set me at a table with white people. I said, well, I'll see you later then. I will see. These are all my friends in here. But we have to acknowledge, then we have to break the cumulative curse. And we can't control that, the cumulative pain, whether it's drugs in your family, mental health in your family, or racism that's intricately in the fabric of our country. So let me wrap up by talking about application to the church. Those were my talking points. The church is a microcosm of the larger community. I want you to hear that. So when you talk about this, this is not a separate conversation from the church and community. And COVID is helping us to see the church ain't just the building. It's all of us in the marketplaces of our life, everywhere we are. If I was in my community, I'd say everywhere I be, right? Everywhere I be, I'm the church, right? So my wedding was important to me. That all the people I love, and I'm not the same political orientation as some of them, whatever, but I love them. They love me. I've been with them through their troubles. They've been with, that's why we got to get to know each other on a micro level, right? I still ain't gonna agree with you on some things, but to know each other on a micro level. The church is a microcosm of the larger society, period. Two, churches are usually homogeneous. People group with people of like whatever, including race, economics, and interests. Integrating a church is a struggle. Travis hired me at Bon Air. Paul remembers that, to integrate the church. Travis and I had healthy debates for 2 years. I told him that I'm not a discipler, but I'm an outreach person. I said I could get people of every nation, tribe, and tongue in this church. I said I could follow them for a year. But after that, if your spiritual formation people ain't ready to connect and to, you know, go deep, I can't help with that. I could just get them here. And then I raised some other questions to the senior pastor. No offense, Daniel, talking about the senior pastor here. I raised some other questions to the senior pastor about class. And he said, we don't need to talk about that. I said, nah, the kind of church Bon Air is, you know, the Black educated people, I'll do okay getting them in. And even a few Black Spanish from South America. But when you talk about the Central American Hispanics, and when you talk about the Blacks on the other side of Bon Air, right? I'm a sociology, I'm a people person, I'm a street person. I take all these variables into consideration. And I don't think they ever got my thinking on this. And sure enough, most of the Blacks that Paul and I left there when we left, that were in your choir, Paul, were professional music teachers and well-spoken individuals that love the hymns and love Paul and love the church. And so these variables matter. When you ask me to help integrate a church, you know, I hate to use words like target and war language, especially these days, but you know, who do you want here? You know, and if I bring the lower income classes in, how will they assimilate? Will people receive them? And those kind of things. So churches are usually homogeneous. A church that is not has to be intentional to make it happen. has to be intentional. It just doesn't happen naturally. Or the individual members just get on fire about Jesus. And if they have multicultural friends, multi-class friends, they bring them because it's their people's job to bring people. The third thing is, and this has to do with the past, and I threw this in after I heard Anna's description just now. In the history of America, remember that blacks and whites used to worship together. There's a whole, all across this country, but we worship in the slave balconies, up narrow staircases. Just by show of hands, how many seen some of those churches in Virginia? I would love to have a year off to travel Virginia before these churches disappear, because I've been to a lot of them. When you take pictures, some of them you also see the gender wall for women on one side and men on the other. And then you see the balcony for the blacks. And there's still some churches, some in Goochland, all in Middleburg, Virginia, because I've been to them for Virginia Baptist. And I would love to take 6 months, and someone needs to take a picture and catalog all these churches. But blacks were worshiping in balconies, but it didn't work for them, right? And Fred Anderson does have some records of the slaves in the balcony or after slavery to Reconstruction, slaves in the balcony. It didn't work because blacks created a Christianity that met the needs of an oppressed people. So when you come to my church and I'm shouting and I'm clapping and I'm hallelujah, it came from the blacks when the white church wasn't able to meet their need because they're telling the slaves obey your masters is what Daniel Glaze is preaching. And it, Paul says it, but we're not going to go into exegesis of scripture. I'll say what Jesus said, but all these kind of things, it didn't work for African Americans. So they would sneak out at night when we weren't allowed to meet and go in the woods. And most of you probably know this. And they called them the brush harbors or the hush harbors, H-U-S-H harbor. And they would go out in the woods and worship from 11 at night, 1 in the morning to 3 or 4, get back to the shack, cabin, whatever you call their house, and be ready to be in the fields in the morning. And so, but out there in the woods, they would scream and holler and get in the spirit, coming back all the way to the African roots, right? So a lot of us still dance in the spirit and we still are very emotive. And so as Black Americans become more upper class, right, and assimilate with higher education and stuff, you are finding a shift in some cases, but we're also seeing a trend back around when they get a certain age, right? When the world beats them up enough and you, because it becomes therapeutic is what it is. So that's for a psychologist to handle. So the Black church was a hybrid of the white church. So, denominations, I had a statement here about denominations. I preach occasionally for St. John's United Church of Christ. So, I've been supplying for their pulpit for a long time. I don't make a big deal out of that. And I know I'm being recorded, but I love the people there. I do a lot of justice work with them. So I just wanted to make a note of denominations. Baptist denomination may be considered, if you made a hierarchy of denominations, would be a lower denomination. Of course, Pentecostal and stuff would be even lower, right? And independent Baptists and other groups. But Episcopal, Lutheran, Anglican, many of those would be considered theologically more progressive, I guess, or, you know, in terms, so at St. John's, I do a lot of the justice thing. So I call St. John's a high church because the issues they choose to champion aren't probably issues I could bring to WU, right, to lead the women in, even though I sort of almost do. But anyway, last thing is, and this is about the church, application to the church. I believe that if our preachers would focus other scriptures, I think Paul and I talked about this at Bonaire years ago. You know, we talk about on Mission Sundays all the time, the Great Commission. I never talk about the Great Commission without talking about the Great Commandment, ever. Where I come from in Baptist life, we always talk about the Great Commission. And which the term Great Commission ain't even in the Bible, but the Great Commandment is said by Jesus. So I never talk about one by itself, ever, ever. I'm not gonna talk about one without the other. And my challenge to preachers is teach our people to read Amos, you know, teach our people to read scripture that we kind of ignore. And all of us, you know, through different seasons of life are introduced to new pieces of scripture, read the same thing and see something else. But I think in the preaching moment and the teaching moment, there's lots of texts that all denominations focus on. So at St. John's, they focus on key verses and skip the other ones. And maybe us as Baptists focus historically that we inherited on certain verses and passages and things. So anyway, that's what I have for you tonight. I don't know where we, how the discussion is going to go. Next week, what I want to talk about is missions in particular and discrimination, colonization, and those kind of things, heathens versus whatever. So I think I'm done, Anna.
Some of you may have some questions that you would like to offer for Valerie.
Or comments.
One thing I noticed in your presentation, and it's more of a comment, although there are some issues with it, is that when you talk about context, and you, the gentleman who left worship when you were preaching, there is an desire to understand the other person as opposed to taking it personally. Yes. And a lot of people on both sides, on any side, are unable to do that. It's not that, not even that they don't want, maybe they don't want to, but some people just aren't able. And I'm wondering about how we help with that.
Well, I totally agree with you, Anna, that some people aren't able. From a micro level, we'll talk about missions next week. I think hands-on missions, doing it together and becoming friends is one of the answers. That doesn't solve the ism problems, that my Black son could still be beat up by the police, which Paul remembers all the stories about my data analytics son, a master's graduate from NC State, lives in a gated community in Ohio. He's been beat up so many times by police, they swear he has drugs and guns. This kid has never given me a trouble. Now, possibly if we had talked about another kid, but anyway, no, he's never been in that kind of trouble. I like to make a joke about that. But where was I going with that question? Oh, yeah. Yeah, people, from the micro point of view, becoming friends is a start. So families become friends, kids become friends, not just when they're little, but when they grow up, right? So that they don't see not only color, but otherly abled and gender. And so you, once you develop a relationship with someone, so on a micro level, missions is a prime avenue to make it happen. On a macro level, it's a cognitive leap. And that's what you're saying. And I agree with you. Some people just can't make that leap. We are so who we were socialized, if you will, or nurtured to be. And it's in the fabric of our society in general. So I remember when I worked at Hillside Center, we went to Ginnam Park Baptist Church for Vacation Bible School. I just decided to get the kids out of there because Daniel knows it was a raggedy place. Everything at the center was raggedy. The community was raggedy. Of course, I got my husband out of it. He raggedy too. But we went to Ginnam Park. We went to Stockton Memorial for Bible School just to get the kids out to see something else. Because I know part of my success is I hung around in Eastern Long Island with very wealthy kids. I played field hockey. I was the only Black on the field hockey team. I went in their RVs camping. I saw something and I knew I had to do something. I didn't want riches or anything. And probably I said the wrong thing, but I didn't want riches, but I knew there was another way. I had to go to school and I've always worked since I was 9 years old. So I wanted to get the Hillside kids out of there to see another way. And so we went back in the park one day and we were singing at the end of Vacation Bible School, all the kids together, Hillside kids, Ginnam Park Baptist Church kids, and Ginnam Park was doing okay at the time. And a kid with, I think, Down syndrome looked at Dwayne, and he was young, they were all young, and said, well, at least I'm not Black. That says it all. That's intricately woven in the fabric. And sometimes it's unconscious. But you're right, I agree with you, Anna, that some people can't make that leap. I have friends that's Black that can't make that leap. I made a suggestion, and I won't say names because Dean knows all of them. I made a suggestion that we do some mission thing, and a Black woman said to me, I don't want to do that. We need to have conversation. I said, but when you serve together, you automatically start talking, being friends, sharing stories, eating together, and you break down some of the stereotypes and beliefs you have about other people, and you begin to see we're not really all that much different, you know, that we're all trying to work, take care of our families, trying to live right. I ask God every day, help me get it right today, because I sure messed it up yesterday, you know.
Other folks?
Valerie, you talked about, you know, how... earlier on in the history of Christianity in our country that African-Americans and whites often worship together. And as you and others on this call know, you can go to many towns across the American South, especially where there are two First Baptist churches, where there was a split off with, you know, the African-Americans having their First Baptist church, the white folks having their First Baptist church. And I've got many friends who pastor at some of these First Baptist churches across the South, and they have mentioned something that I found interesting. As important and as called as they are to the work of trying to build relationships with the two First Baptist churches, try to rejoin them, when they do so, it often brings the disparities into living color, we might say, or stark relief. Yes. So both difficult yet necessary work. And I don't know that, because I do not pastor one such church like that and have not done some of that joint reconciliation work, I don't know that I appreciated that dimension to that reconciliation work, that part of the reconciliation work requires that we speak some truths and that we see some truths, and that's hard work, because I think speak for myself, we as mission-minded Baptists would rather just do a project together.
Yes,
because that can be a way we can focus our energy there rather than the interior work of how we have contributed to the world we have. So that was just some thoughts that came to mind when you were talking about our history of worshiping together, and then that went in some different directions.
Well, you're actually right about it's hard work, and most of us are not going to use our lifetime doing the work. It's hard work. And the micro things of mission trips is only a small beginning of getting to know people and not being afraid. When I moved south, I didn't understand why Black people were so scared of white people. I'm a New Yorker. Need I say more? You know, and my late husband and even my current one, both Southern, you know, Virginians. And you said that in front of those white people, or why did you do this? And why did I said, what? You know, I don't know what you're talking about. I have a different, the context in which I was born, just a different orientation. But let me speak to this Black-white church thing a long time ago. When we left the white churches to start our own, one of the primary reasons was doing that was one, the theology preached from the pulpits, but also the fact that we wanted to be in charge. One thing, the reason why a lot of Black churches don't want to partner with white churches, and I know this for a fact from experience, is they say, we're not in charge of nothing. Everywhere we go, white folks in charge. They're the boss, they call the shots, they got more than us. We are in charge of one thing. Now we're starting to get more entrepreneurial, and Black young people are diversifying different means of income and all this kind of stuff, you know, my kids. But historically, we were only in charge in church. So the guy who worked in sharecropping, he might've been called boy, or maybe the N word or whatever else during the week. But when he came to church on Sunday, he was brother, deacon, reverend, minister, elder. That's why we still use titles. Now, I don't know if we know why we still use, titles are very important in our church. I went to a funeral once at Mount Tabor, and Travis Collins came with me, and we were going the wrong way down the aisle or something. I don't know. One of the lady deacons took her finger like this. She heard me call Travis. And she said, you do not call him Travis. That's Dr. So every time Travis went to Hillside with me for a gangbang infernal, because he would go with me some of the early days, or if he went to, I had to make sure I called him Dr. Collins, because status, most of these people won't get their status from their house or their education at, you know, University of Richmond or whatever, but their status is, I'm deacon so-and-so in the church. So I might be in a maintenance outfit all week long, but in the church, I have a name. And when I get to heaven, I'm going to have a new name too. And ain't nobody gonna put me out, and I'm gonna walk around heaven all day, right? And so titles are important, but I have one more thing to say with what Daniel said about the two churches. A lot of people, want a church that's just priestly, Daniel, in my opinion. You know, the church meets a lot of different needs. So justice is one of them, but pastoral care, you know, all those other kind of things. And so like this man who gets up and walks out, this church is my safe place. I'm 80 something years old. The world is daggone changing too daggone fast for me. At least my Jesus and my church need to be predictable. The human mind has to have continuity and some predictability. Some September 11, some COVID experiences, we can adapt and adjust, but a human mind can't have like this. We need predictability. That's why we put our children on a schedule and they go to bed at a certain time, and they have to have predictability. So someone's religion, their place of worship, the place where they meet God, it needs to be somewhat, that's why rituals are so part of religion. They need some predictability. So I'm not making an excuse, Daniel, that we shouldn't do the racial reconciliation work, but I think churches end up on a continuum of priestly and prophetic, right? So you get that radical racial reconciliation church. So you get the Eastern Fellowship that moves into right around the corner from my house and upset with me because I won't be the Black matriarch as they grow their church. I was mad because I saw all the gentrification and I said in 10 years it won't matter anyway because ain't no Black people gonna be here because we can't afford to live over there, right? And so it's such a dichotomy. And I think, Daniel, wherever we can find those connecting points, whether it's what Mount Tabor and Jim Somerville's church is doing, not only do we exchange different things we do together, but we do a lot of Wednesday night switching together, discussions, hearing each other's stories. That is not the whole answer to a macro systemic problem. But it might make a difference when one of our young people at Mount Tabor go for a job interview and the person goes to First Baptist Church. Because all that goes together, employment, income. You know, I remember first going to Bonaire and we have a lot of people, you know, the Estes, Chick-fil-A people, all these people. And it was a new world for me. I didn't know women didn't work. I never knew there were stay-at-home housewives. And I came home and I said to Holland, these women don't work. He said, don't even think about it. That's all he said. My husband said, don't even think about it. And then the other thing I didn't understand, and I was beat in the spirit, whooped in the spirit, when I was in the women's groups in the early days at Pioneer, and they would talk about their problems. I remember thinking, that's a problem? That's a problem? But it's context. And the Lord corrected me and disciplined me in the spirit because for those sisters, they were issues for them. And I had to affirm that as a minister and understand that as a sister. But my first reaction, not publicly, of course, it's like, they ain't no problem. Shoot, I wish all of us in my company had that problem, right? But it's all perspective and context. So. In WMU, Virginia, if you go to WMUV.org, I put a facilitator's guide online called SPA, S-P-A, Women on Mission and Racial Reconciliation. I started a group after the Black Lives Matter movement, a group that I thought was only going to be one time only for 6 weeks. Well, God is in it because the group is meeting now after the 6 weeks every month, Black, White, Hispanic. We have three new groups that have started, one in Lynchburg, then the Baptist Nursing Fellowship of Nurses in Virginia, starting looking at healthcare disparities with Christian nurses. And just look at the guide of what we started in Virginia WU. When I had the vision, I told my board that I had this vision because some women were saying, are we going to march and are we going to do this? And I said, well, I always know what position I'm in. Paul, you know that, right? I always walk that line. When I used to get up in the pulpit at Bonaire, Paul used to say, oh God, what is she going to say? And then one day, Paul, I don't know if I can tell on you, but one day Paul came to me and he said, did you see the senior pastor? He's always on the edge of the seat when you're up there because he don't know what you're going to say. I said, Paul, I've been around a long time and I know where my bread is buttered. I walk that line, but I know how far to go. So, but when I came to my board of WMU and said I had this vision for a 6-week process, the board didn't like it. And Diane, you know the process of all the board didn't like it, but there was enough new members on the board that adopted it. And it's taken a life of its own. We're up to the fourth cohort. I'm exhausted. But these women are sharing their stories. Some are horrible. And some of the white women have horrible stories. And they're sharing and loving each other. And at first they were angry with each other. We had one Black lady who's WMU in Fredericksburg, wanted every white woman to apologize to her. And I'm a facilitator, so I can't talk. you know, I'm just facilitating. By the end of the 6 weeks, you should see how they've all come together as sisters. They're still meeting, they're doing things, they're sharing stories every month. And she shared a story last week on their monthly meeting that at her school in Fredericksburg, the white teacher is the African-American studies teacher. And she said, I don't like the way he was teaching something. And usually I would have went and just told him off. I would have laid him out teaching black studies like that and blah, blah, blah. But after SPA and after hearing the stories of the white man, now I realize that that's the language he knows. That's the way he was taught this, right? He wasn't intentionally trying to hurt the black cause. So it's education, Anna, education, awareness, and introspection and soul searching. And most of us don't do that work. The clinical work we don't like to do.
Dr. Carter.
Just Valerie.
Okay, thank you, Valerie. I was struck by something you said, that historically black churches were organized because blacks wanted to be in charge of their own theology and worship. I read somewhere earlier this year that part of the problem of blacks and whites sitting down together is that in these conversations, you always seem to hear the white voices first. And I wouldn't blame people for thinking that whites want to be in charge and this is our idea and this is what we're going to do. How do you suggest that we deal with that so that we can get something going without trying to be in charge?
Well, that's a very good question and a good question after SPA. I would suggest that you look at that guy, Kathy Berry. Y'all know Kathy Berry, many of you do. She's working with me now on taking that SPA process and develop a curriculum for our churches. SPA does just that. There's no hierarchy. The blacks aren't higher, the Spanish, the whites. It's not that. So it's a process that was intentionally designed so that all voices are heard equally. You know, a hard work process. You have to have a great facilitator, but it works. My experience is that it's usually the black voices that are the most assertive, loud, and angry. Because one thing we haven't mentioned here is the anger and rage in the black community and the lack of trust. So the work I do, I get grief from blacks all the time. How can you put up with them white people? They lie, they steal, they cheat. You know, and that's what the media says about us. But they're talking about lie, steal, cheat systemically and historically, right? So you go to Liberia, you know, Europeans took everything. You go, you know, all the resources and Native Americans. But my experience is that we're usually the more assertive storyteller, so we've had a different experience in that. But I would suggest you look at that SPA process, and I'm not touting WU, we're doing okay, but the process is working. And I'm happy what God is doing. I'm a little overwhelmed and exhausted right now, and a lot of ministers probably say amen to that with me. And I didn't think it would take on a life of its own, so I'm very happy, but I'm not happy, because I don't have the energy to do anything else. So I just wrote a grant to get facilitators to do some of this work because it's needed. So I do have some videos. If you would like me to send Anna one of our sessions to see how these stories work with white and black playing off each other, they were beautiful. Like one white lady from Appomattox shared that she had to go to school during integration and the assistant principal is black and the senior principal is white. But the black girls used to beat her up, and she took a seat once and she was there first. And the black girl came to beat her up. Get out of my seat. Y'all know how that goes. And she goes to the office. She gets in trouble and loses some kind of academic status because of this altercation. And by the sixth week of this process, even the black woman was saying, that's wrong. That's wrong. If you were sitting there first, you know, there's a lot of other dynamics going on. So we do have some, I could send Anna, if y'all would be interested in seeing it, it'd be worth for one of these Wednesday sessions, just watching the whole thing. You know, it's an hour and a half. And you, to see these women go into stories, I don't want to start because I'm a storyteller, I'll keep going, but amazing. And the enlightenment, for instance, one black woman wanted all the white people to apologize to her. So I didn't say much to 6 weeks as a facilitator, but when I did have time to say something, I didn't feel that. I felt differently than that black woman. I didn't feel all white women needed to apologize to me. I feel a system needs to make it right to the masses of black people. How do they do that? I don't know. Through education, through reparations. I don't know. I don't have, that's really not my bailiwag. But I don't think Anna needs to apologize to me for what her great grandfather did. So the lady from Urbana talked about her great grandfather would be upset about the monuments. And we had ground rules, so people could say whatever they want. No one was mad at nobody. And so, you know, the black woman wanted an apology for her grandfather. And when she apologized, which she felt led to apologize, I would not have. I'm sorry. The black girl said, now I feel better. And I'm thinking, you feel better because she apologized? Okay. I couldn't say that. I'm the facilitator. But when my time came a couple of weeks later, I said, I don't think any of you owe me an apology. I think the system needs to make the injustice right with black Americans because we built this country for no benefit.
Valerie, related to the question about, you know, kind of the white voice being dominant, not only is that racial, it's also from an American perspective. When you and I know this, when we go internationally and talk with our partners outside of the country, a lot of times that American voice feels like it needs to dominate the conversation in an international setting all the time.
Yes.
And so part of it, I think, is racial. But I think part of it is American, is an American culture of, and you can call that dominance or control. I don't know exactly what it is, but, and that goes beyond races sometimes too, because I've seen just as many black Americans in an international setting be that louder voice over top of people who aren't American. And I think at least one of the things that I've learned is, and I think COVID has kind of helped this a little bit, we need to figure out how to stay in this listening posture that COVID has forced some of us into. You know, when COVID hit and all of a sudden all the churches closed their doors for in-person meetings, a lot of ministers and a lot of others and a lot of us had to start listening to experts who knew how to do technology that, and we had to learn and we had to be quiet and learn something that maybe we didn't want to learn, but it put us in a learning and a listening posture that now we're seeing the benefits from it. So if we can continue in a listening posture rather than in a talking posture, as I'm talking now, I think we're going to be better off as we move into these conversations and as we just move forward in general.
And what you're doing, Dean, in this class in SPA, that's exactly all it is. It's a beginning. It is a beginning. Let me say something about some of my experiences, and I don't know, Dean, why you triggered this. But even being the WMU exec, I don't talk about this much because I've been in Virginia Baptist Life since 1988. I'm on my last season of the journey. But as exec, I take discrimination and ridicule and disrespect at an unprecedented level that I know my last three predecessors didn't take. Now, I'm not saying they didn't take some passive aggressive behavior behind the scenes of staff or whatever, I'm sure. But sometimes I get so frustrated because I have reorganized WMU Virginia to be transparent. The board has governance and ministries. There's nothing secret. I meet with the finance committee and accountant every month so that we don't wait just three times a year to go over all the finances. I have been, and I don't need to pat myself on the back. I'm past that. I just turned 60, so it doesn't matter. Right? There's something beautiful about this stage in life because you just don't care anymore. You really don't. But I tell them, let my reputation speak for me in Virginia Baptist Life. But the disrespect I get sometimes from staff, from board members, it is not right. It is not right. It is not right. Especially when I've been beyond reproach. Black middle class parents teach their kids, you have to work harder, smarter, longer, get more education just to even get a chance. That's what we teach our kids. Now, it's mainly Black middle class families that do that, right? So as WMU exec, I was scared to come because of the generational curse and pattern of firing execs, right? So I didn't want to come leave Bonnier and come there when I got called. I didn't call them, they called me. I said, I ain't coming, y'all unhealthy. So I got Steve, I said, if I'm coming, y'all better do some Bowen family systems theory because I ain't work, I'm too old. I'm not working in an unhealthy system. I'm just not, to the degree that, I mean, all of us are unhealthy to a degree, but I mean, just outright sickness. I said, that has to be cleaned up, right? So I had Steve Allsbrook come in, the former DOM of Dover, and did a couple of retreats on Bowen for us. Some people thought I was crazy, but they didn't, you know, they needed to understand, you know, healthy functioning. And right now we're doing well, but I do take, I walk under in stress because you want to be beyond reproach. And some of that I put on myself. I own that. Some I put on myself. I've been working since I was 9 years old. And when you're the minority, you always want to prove, Joe, I'm working. Travis, I'm, what else do you need? I'm here 7 days a week. The only person who works more than me is Paul Honegger. You know, the need, where did that need come from? My white woman counterparts don't have that need. You know, when, why didn't I ever, and some women, a lot of women don't like this though, but why didn't I learn self-care somewhere along the way? I'm working, Travis, I'm working. I'm here 6 days a week. I used to have a saying, don't nobody work more than me but Paul Honegger, because he works seven. But then we have others, especially big time folks who work 3 and 2 days. Why couldn't I feel good about deciding I'm going to work 3 days a week and stay home? Well, first of all, it wouldn't have worked. We held that a different standard. It's the same mantra women can say sometimes with men. Different standard. So that's a stressor for me in this season of my life. But again, I turned 60, so I'm trying to just wipe it off and not worry about it. Just do the best I can till the end or until Jesus comes. COVID takes me out, whatever.
Well, there's a lot of us in WMU, Valerie, that appreciate the work that you do, and you don't hear from us because everything's going good. So just right. Realize that there's probably more positive things said about you than what you hear.
Well, thank you. And I don't mean the audience. I mean like a supervisor. Oh, our Virginia Baptist people. Oh my God. Love them from here to the Eastern Shore to Southwest Virginia Gate City. Love them all. But staff, you know, when you're in an authority position, you know, I taught my kids not to use race as an excuse. I have 2 African-American sons. And I always told them from little boys, we taught them at 3 and 4 how to hold the steering wheel with police stop. And when the daddy used to get a speeding ticket, I used to say when they were little, watch your daddy, because one day you're going to have to do this. We really talk to our kids like that. Watch how he keeps his hands up here. I got to get my wallet. It's over there. Can I get it? Because he'd be shot. I mean, we always knew that, you know, but I also told my boys, never use the race card. Sometimes it will be race, but don't use that card. Just work smart, pull your weight, you know, and be responsible. But I find in the last 2 years, I've used the race card twice. I've never used the race card. Paul, you work with me forever. Have I used the race card? I have used the race card. And I'm embarrassed to tell you all that. Yeah, but I don't want to go on and tell you long stories about how, and I'm talking about more WMU staff, Melody, the staff, the board of trustees, Diane, you know, and I've used the race card twice. And I'm embarrassed, but for me to call race, most likely it was race. And I married a truck driver, and Dean could tell you, we have board issued cars, vehicles, and our spouses drive them. Dean, is that right? Not in your case? It's always been that way. So I wanted to let the insurance company know when, after I got married, said I'd do that, my husband would be driving the car. If he's going with me to Gate City, the other day he went to me with Trapville Baptist Church, he'd go with me to Motley. If he's not on the road himself, he owns his own business. So if he doesn't work, he don't get no money. So he got to stay on the road. And I know this is being recorded, but it is what it is. The accountant calls the president, not me, and says she wants us to put him on the car. Now, and you talk about social class too. So even though he makes like 2 or 3 times the amount of money I do driving a truck, but my point is status, you know. If he had been the CFO of the bank and married me, would they have acted? Maybe they would have acted the same way, but I could not help during Black Lives Matter, but see a Black man, you know, I said, he don't want your car. You want me to drive to Gate City? And he's in the car with me. Then you'll be talking about, look at that Black man, let his wife take charge. Black women don't charge the family anyway, most of the time because of our history in America. It was drama. Do you hear me? The president calls me. Oh, it was terrible. The receptionist gets involved. She says, I don't like this. He shouldn't be able to drive the car. What's the issue? He has a truck, a trailer, and a car. He doesn't need a car. My point is, he takes me places, and I like to sit and go to sleep. Right? So, and I call the race card. I am embarrassed about that, but I can't see it no other way. I've never asked anybody for anything. And Paul, you know that. I work, and I work extra and more extra. I'll rake your leaves if I need money first. Can I rake your leaves or paint your house?
Anyone else have any comments that you'd like to make or questions?
Do want to thank Melody. Thank you for that. Good to see you.
Well, I'm already looking forward to next week.
Thank you, Bill. Sure,
thank you. We're going to talk about missions, I think, in the church. Something. I don't know. I'll figure it out. Anna will correct me if I'm going in the wrong direction. We need to do something else.
You're all right. Thank you. Well, I know that there are a few things that you've said this evening that should have been common sense to me, such as how important the titles were to the Black community in their church, because that was their one place to have status. It had never, ever occurred to me that that's why those titles were so important. And so, you know, every conversation that we can have to learn a little something can make us more compassionate, more understanding. I sure hope. So I thank all of you for being here tonight and look forward to seeing you again next Wednesday night. Valerie, thank you so much. We'll see you then. Good night, friends.